Good evening, everybody. I admire the fact that on a cold February evening you came here tonight. I was telling the other day this story about President Kennedy from the United States that visited the Alcatraz prison near San Francisco, which was open for many years and was one of the most difficult prisons. And when he came to the prison, they asked him to speak to the prisoners. So he didn't know how to open up his remarks. And he said, "I'm glad you are all here." So I'm glad you're all here. The subject of my talk, which is what was proposed, is really the breakthrough in the peace efforts in the Middle East, which began with the Egyptian visit of President Sadat to Jerusalem back in November 1977, and culminated almost a year later, which will be 40 years soon, in the Camp David Accords, and then in March 79, the Treaty of Peace between Israel and Egypt. I was fortunate to be a member of our delegation to the peace talks with Egypt from the Camp David team of Israel, which was headed by Prime Minister Begin, a graduate of the Warsaw University. Only three of us remain alive. And 40 years, I was the youngest member of the Israeli team. But I would like to proceed my talk about those days by referring very briefly to the current situation between Israel and Poland. I think it's just appropriate, and by chance, I came here just in the days of the crisis, which of course was not pre-planned. Israel and Poland have an important history and an important current relations. The history everybody knows, it goes back 1,000 years. This museum, and I am appreciative of Nili Amit, who's here, who invited me, and she's here with her husband, Dr. Kozlowski, a former ambassador of Poland to Israel. The history is recorded in this museum, and it's 1,000 years of history. But it also had a bitter end, and this is the Holocaust, of course. I come from a family that suffered from the Holocaust. My father grew up in Poland. Now his little town is in Belarus. It was on the boundary between Poland and Russia, between the two world wars, and now it's Belarus. It was on the Polish side. My father served in the Polish army. He then was a prisoner of war with the Soviets. When they had the agreement with Germany, the Ribbentrop-Molotov agreement, his family was all shot into a mass grave in the shtetl, in the town, his parents, his sisters, his brother-in-law, his nephew, baby. And my wife's family is from Warsaw, and they all were, in fact, I discovered the graves of her grand and great-grandfathers here. They were all sent to Treblinka during the Holocaust. So the history is well known, but there's also a current history which is of good relations, not only including many visits for historical tools, but also schools and so on. All my daughters came here with schools, but also science, medicine, business, all of this has been flourishing. And now we have this crisis. And what we feel, and I now am a free man, I'm not in government or in the court anymore, but as a citizen, while I cannot analyze the reasons for the decisions here to make this law, but from an Israeli point of view, there are two major problems. But let me say, before I say what the problems are, that I hear all the time here that Poland is concerned that people speak of Polish concentration camps, Polish extermination camps. I was the one who established monitoring of anti-Semitism in our government many years ago, and I've been living in Israel all my life. This is not the Israeli vocabulary, regular vocabulary. We don't speak of Polish extermination camps. We speak of extermination camps, Nazi extermination camps in Poland. And that's a hell of a difference, of course. There were Poles who helped Jews, 7,000 were recorded in Yad Vashem, our national memorial, as virtues among the nations who helped Jews during the Holocaust, endangering their own life. But there were many, many Poles, as you all know, who collaborated, who were anti-Semitic, who worked against the Jews. This is Poles. We don't speak of Poland as such. Poland didn't exist during the Holocaust in terms of a government in the country. It was in London, in exile. So what bothers us in the law is two things. One is the message, and the other is the language. The message is as if, and it looks like, as if Poland is backing away from the notion of the Holocaust. And the other is the language. I'm a lawyer, I was a judge for many years. If you read the text of the law, you cannot understand how a court of law, I'm saying it with respect to your parliament, how a court of law can implement this law, because the court is requested to be a historian, to decide what exactly a nation is, what exactly a scientific criticism versus a defamation, what about the freedom of press. And suppose an American, an Israeli, a British visitor says something, maybe the government doesn't mean it, but if somebody comes and complains to the police, hey, this guy said this or that, the police, what would they do? Open an investigation, start to interpret if this sentence was this way or this way. All these things are problematic. So I will stop here. I only say that a dialogue is what is needed. And it's a pity the dialogue didn't take place before the law was finalized in the parliament, but still there's the presidential stage. And in the presidential stage, there are many possibilities of a dialogue, inter alia, also of sending it back to the Constitutional Court to check all kinds of legal. I don't have to advise Poland, but we feel the dialogue should be fruitful, should be meaningful. And I think it's in the interest of both societies and both countries. And I felt I had to say it ahead of my remarks on what we are here to hear tonight. So let me go back now to 1977. As you may know, until between 1948, when Israel was established, and 1977, there were five wars with Egypt. Five wars. 48, 56, 67, the war of attrition after 67, and 73. Many losses for both sides, and the notion that Israel should not be recognized should not be negotiated with. Our Declaration of Independence in 48 says that Israel extends the hand of peace to the neighbors. It was not accepted in those days. 77 did not look like a year of promise. Why? Because on one hand side, a new American president was elected, President Carter, who started his tenure in January of 77, and who had a mission to help the Palestinians. In May, a change occurred in Israeli government, an unexpected change. For 30 years, the Labor Party was ruling Israel, and in May of 77, the Likud Party under Prime Minister Begin, whom I already mentioned, came to power. He was of the ideology which was an ideology of attachment to the territories that we held after 1967, mainly what's known as Judea and Samaria, or the West Bank, and Gaza. And he and Carter, in normal, quote-unquote, analysis, would have been portrayed as going in opposite directions. President Carter welcomed Mr. Begin to Washington by a proposal known as the Geneva Conference. Geneva Conference was something which began in 1973, but never took off, and it involved the United Nations, involved all kinds of Arab parties, and Syria was opposing it. By the way, in a jocular way, you know, the two governing resolutions of the United Nations at the time were 242 and 338. 242 from 1967 and 338 from 1973. A couple of years earlier, I was the number two person in our embassy in Washington. And my wife said I was 38, you should have a checkup, medical checkup. So I went to see a doctor in Washington, and he called me a few days later. He said, you're okay, except that you have a somewhat high cholesterol. I said, what's the number? He said, 242. I said, for an Israeli diplomat, it's a great number. It's good you don't give me 338. He said, what are you talking about? So years later, when we were negotiating with the Jordanians, with the Palestinians, I used to tell them 248 is just cholesterol, don't mention it. That's kind of jocularly. In any case, the Syrians were opposed. It didn't look like going anywhere. The main problem with Geneva was that the Palestinian representation was not available. Israel at the time would not speak to the PLO because of its commitment to the destruction of Israel, and there were no other Palestinians at the time willing to sit with us. What are we doing? On the side, a channel of contact with Egypt was created. Part of it was through Romania. The main part of it was through Morocco. And in fact, I was at the time the assistant to Foreign Minister Moshe Dayan. I don't know if all of you know his name. He was a great name in our history. He was the one-eyed war hero. And I was his lawyer, one of his lawyers in the inquiry committee after the Yom Kippur War. So when he became foreign minister in 77, he suggested to me to be his chief of cabinet, and I agreed. He was meeting with an Egyptian representative in Morocco, in a clandestine way. The name of the representative was Tuhami. I also met him somewhat later. There was talk about how to continue. It was clear to us that President Sadat, while he was, as an Arab leader, interested in the Palestinian issue, his main wish was to get back Sinai, which was occupied by us during the War of 67. And for Egypt, it was a question of a national pride, national soil. The 73 effort, which ended in a failure from their point of view, but with a lot of casualties for Israel in the War of Yom Kippur, was meant, and they succeeded initially, to cross the canal, the Suez Canal, that was closed since 67. And you know, the Suez Canal is between mainland Egypt and Sinai, and to get back Sinai. There is a myth, a story, as if Dayan, in those meetings with, in the meeting with Tuhami, promised Sinai back to Egypt. That's not true. He said, when the Egyptians talked about it, he said, what I can do is transmit your request to Prime Minister Begin. But he could not promise Sinai. So here we are now in October, November 1977. The UN speech by the Egyptian foreign minister was in the same old language of the anti-Israeli vocabulary that the Arab countries used for many years. The Egyptian foreign minister was Fahmy. But here, on November 9, 1977, President Sadat makes a speech in their parliament. And he said, I'm ready to go to the end of the world, to go to Jerusalem to talk to the Israelis peace, to go to their parliament. When we heard the speech, it sounded like an interesting speech, but nobody really thought that it was operative. I remember the next day, the very next day, there was a meeting between Foreign Minister Dayan and the American ambassador, whose name was Sam Lewis. And I attended the meeting, and they spoke Geneva. And at the end of the meeting, they said both, hey, Sadat had an interesting speech yesterday, which means he was taken as a good speech, but not as an operative move. It took two more days, and we understood that he meant business, quote unquote. And what he did was basically saying, I'm coming. Prime Minister Begin and President Sadat were totally different people. It reflected itself later at Camp David. Sadat was kind of speaking in historical big terms. Begin could also do that, but he was also a lawyer, and he was interested in the operative text and so on. But they had the two of them had one thing in common besides the wish to have peace. And what was it? Drama. The sense of drama. And Begin loved drama, and Sadat did. So when Sadat, in the next 2 days, gave the impression that this was going the right way in terms of a visit, Begin issued the invitation and said, Mr. President, you are welcome in Jerusalem. Now, we are now November 13. And when Sadat said yes, the visit took place Saturday night, November 19. So from November 9, the speech, when it was perceived as a statement, and between November 19, when it took place, just 10 days went by. And you should have seen the enthusiasm in Israel to this visit. All the officials, everybody was just busy and wanted to take place and participate and so on. I was not supposed to be at the airport by my protocol rank at the time. I was a 30-year-old guy, the assistant to Dayan, but the protocol list didn't include me. But in the early hours of the evening of November 19, Saturday night, Dayan, my mentor, called me and said, "Would you like to come to the airport?" I said, "Yes." And sure enough, I went with him to the airport. And to this very day, if I talk on national events, and I had many of them thereafter, I was heading the negotiation for the Treaty of Peace with Jordan, many other things. The most moving moment in my Israeli life, so to speak, or one of them at least, and I don't speak of family matters, was to be at the airport that night. There's a saying, the wings of history. So that night, seeing the airplane landing in the Ben-Gurion airport was like hearing the wings of history. Not all Israelis, I said Israelis were enthusiastic. On the military side, there were some people, including very senior players, who thought that it may be some kind of a trap, that maybe from the airplane, people with guns would come out and shoot the entourage, shoot the welcoming group of ministers and so on. That was not the case. Sadat came, he shook everybody's hands, and here is the visit. I came back to Jerusalem, squeezed between the security person and the driver, while in the back of the car were Dayan and Boutros Ghali, who was then a minister of state in the foreign ministry of Egypt, and later became the Secretary General of the United Nations. I should add that Sadat's visit was not very welcomed by his own entourage. The foreign minister, whom I mentioned before, Fahmy, resigned because of the visit. Moreover, after the agreement at Camp David, which I'll come to in a few minutes, some of his officials, senior officials, resigned. So here is the visit. What comes out of the visit? A visit is speeches, good speeches at the Knesset. Begin, Sadat, welcoming him. Everything looked fine, but quo vadis, where do we go from here? And the question was, how will those beautiful words of no more war, never again war, how are they to be translated into what's known in Yiddishized Hebrew as tachlis, or the real thing? A month later, Begin is invited to Egypt. Not to Cairo, because Sadat wasn't sure about inviting Begin to Cairo. He was invited to Ismailia, which is the town on the shore of the Suez Canal. And Sadat welcomed him. In between, I accompanied Dayan to Morocco to another meeting with this Egyptian emissary to Hami, hosted by the king of Morocco, who's now deceased, King Hassan. And we discussed what's going on. And again, we proposed a certain withdrawal in Sinai, not from the whole Sinai. We discussed something about Syria, and the Egyptians refused to talk about Syria. In fact, Dayan wrote a memo, and I translated it to English, and it had a very short paragraph on Syria. So the Egyptian emissary just folded it and tore it like that and gave it to Dayan and said that you deal with Syria themselves, don't deal with us on Syria. But the Palestinian issue came up, and again I said, Sadat took interest, but it, in my view, wasn't his main interest. Then in Ismailia, we started talking about formulas for peace. And it was very, very difficult. Because on one hand side, the two leaders spoke of no more war. Begin spoke of a treaty of peace. They really spoke nicely. But the officials in Egypt in particular were very, very reserved, to say the least. And Sadat was ahead of them. He wanted, so first we had another meeting in Jerusalem this time, but not in the level of the leadership, but in the next level. The foreign minister came, and it was called the political committee. There was another committee, military committee. The political committee was in January 78 and lasted 2 days. The U.S. was the two. By the way, there was an internal debate in Israel whether the U.S. should be a participant and a mediator, or we should do it all directly with the Egyptians. And Dayan, my mentor, was of the school that said the U.S. is needed, because for Sadat to make concessions would be easier with the U.S. being there, because they can help financially because of their strategic influence and so on. So a day after, or 2 days after, this political committee in Jerusalem was convened, Sadat called them back. I think the reason was criticism within Egypt that he went too far. Jerusalem and so on. And I'll say in brackets that negotiating in Jerusalem became later a problem. So when we discussed the Palestinian issue with the Egyptians later, after Camp David, it was usually in places in Israel which are not Jerusalem. I don't know how many of you visited, but places like Herzliya, Tel Aviv, and Netanya, this kind of thing, not in Jerusalem. But later, when we discussed bilateral relations with Egypt on agreements on bilateral relations, this Sadat agreed, provided that will be in Jerusalem, provided that the negotiators will not spend the night in Jerusalem, but go to Tel Aviv for the hotels. So when Begin heard this, he said, a gentleman doesn't ask the other gentleman where he spends his nights. So this was the compromise for the normalization talk, but we are not yet there. Sadat called back the delegation. He used an excuse that Begin said in a dinner that he gave the delegation, he called the Egyptian foreign minister, the new foreign minister, young man. His name was Muhammad Ibrahim Kamel, and he sat with Sadat in the British prison in World War II. So he said, young man, and as if it was an insult. Begin didn't mean an insult, but it was a convenient excuse, and the Egyptian delegation was called back. So what do we do now? We are January 78, what next? Now began a very agonizing period of 7 months of ups and downs. We had this great spirit of the visit, but how is it to be implemented? So there were meetings of defense minister met with Sadat. There was a meeting between the foreign minister with the U.S. in England, in Leeds Castle. I attended it. It didn't seem working, and the relations between Israel and the U.S. became very sore, very tense. And then President Carter decided basically to gamble. He decided to convene a conference at Camp David in September of 78. Now, why do I say gamble? Because usually these kind of conferences are pre-prepared in a way that the leaders come with basically the results, or almost the results. Here, it was open-ended, open with the readiness, with whatever, with the contents. I should say, Israel is very critical of President Carter for many years. He's not been our favorite for many years. That doesn't mean, and I always say that we should not give him the credit of Camp David. Because he basically gave up all other problems and concentrated for what became 13 days, Begin used to say, 13 days and 13 nights. It was 13 days and 12 nights, but that doesn't matter. We didn't think it was going to be an agreement. When we entered, all the Egyptians, we were hoping that if it will be for like 4 days and there will be a positive continuity, that will be good enough. And that was our assumption. When we were preparing ourselves in New York, I remember before we went to Camp David, that was the assumption. But no. Now let me say a word about Camp David. Camp David is the resort place of the President of the United States. It is in the mountains of Maryland. Beautiful place if you don't have to negotiate there. I was there 3 times, in 78, 79, and 2000 with the Palestinians. But we will not talk about 2000 today. It's a beautiful place. It was established during World War II for President Roosevelt. President Roosevelt was not well, was a sick person, basically. He loved the sea. He loved the ships. He loved to be on the sea. But he couldn't anymore because of his health problems. So they decided to establish a camp of resort which has a view of the sea and also is run by the Navy, the United States Navy, although it has nothing to do with the beach. So he will have the feeling of the sea. It was called Camp David years later by President Eisenhower, naming it after his grandson, David, who, by the way, married the daughter of President Nixon, Eisenhower's deputy. We came to Camp David. It is, you know, cabins. And I was with Diane and our Attorney General until then, Barak, and the legal advisor of the foreign ministry was then in one cabin. And Begin had a cabin. Begin was very democratic. Every day, the whole delegation, we were 13 Israelis, I don't speak of security guys and the communications guy, there were 13 members of the core delegation, and we convened three times every day in Mr. Begin's cabin to discuss what was going on. By the way, the Americans brought kosher food for everyone wanted, and there was one important thing which I should mention. There was no media. The media was kept in a little town called Thurmond, few miles, couple of miles from Camp David. All they got was, and we were banned from communicating with the media. We had a press person, but all he did was to give what's known in the media language as color stories. That is, who ate kosher, who drove bicycle, who met with whom, who all kinds of things like that. No substance. So problematic it was for the media that I remember one morning I was in our communications cabin and the phone rang and I pick up the phone. And there's a well-known journalist from Jerusalem. And he says, what's going on? I said, oi. Oi, which means the Jewish sigh. And he said, what do you mean? I said, you know, we are banned from press work. And what was the next day, the headline in his newspaper? Concern in the Israeli delegation attributed to me. Because of the oi. So, in the first 5-6 days, each delegation, Israel and Egypt, presented their case. We came with a Treaty of Peace draft. The Egyptians did the same. And then on Sunday, we came there Tuesday. Sunday, after the first stage, so to speak, we all went for a visit to Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, which is the Civil War, American Civil War battlefield. And when we came back from there, there's a picture in my office from that visit. When we came back from Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, the real thing started. And there were 23 drafts on the table between this Sunday, which was September 10, and the next Sunday, which was the day we finished and we signed. 23 drafts. And what was it about? And these were days in which, as I said, the President of the U.S., the Secretary of State, Cyrus Vance, a very good man, and others, dedicated basically all the time, when the Iran crisis was starting, with the Shah would later fall. But here we are. What were the problems? There was the Egyptian bilateral Israeli problem, Sinai, and there was the Palestinian issue. On the Palestinian issue, I should have mentioned that in November, earlier, 10 months earlier, Begin submitted a plan of autonomy for the Palestinians. And he shared it with Carter, with the British government, with others. Autonomy in the West Bank and Gaza, Judea and Samaria and Gaza. The Americans took the autonomy plan and changed it, but left the frame. And they spoke of a 5-year autonomy, not a permanent or a for years and years, in which in the third year will begin the permanent status negotiations, in which Jordan will be involved, and the Palestinians and so on. Remember, we are only with Egyptians. There are no Palestinians in Camp David. Then was the Sinai issue. Israel was reluctant to withdraw from the whole Sinai because of security concerns. I mentioned there were 5 wars between Israel and Egypt between 48 and 73. And there was concern. And there was oil in Sinai. But during those days, it became clear that without a promised withdrawal from the whole Sinai, there will be no deal. Begin was agonizing. And I think Dayan gave him the key for a solution by telling him, listen, if you agree to that, condition it on a Knesset approval. That is, you are signing something which is subject to Knesset approval. Begin agonized and decided this way. Now, in the last 4 days when the language was discussed, the Americans felt that they had a problem because Sadat was not a text person. Begin was a text person. What to do? They couldn't put them in one room and deal with the text. So they jumped to the 2 senior legal advisors at the time, to Osama Elbaz, who was an Egyptian person, and to Barak. Aaron Barak was our senior legal advisor. And Carter personally sat with them, and they came back to the delegation to discuss what was proposed, and that is how it worked on the last 4 days. Then a problem jumped. Jerusalem. As we already were moving to an agreement on the language of the autonomy, which was very difficult, on the Sinai issue, the Americans came up with Jerusalem. It was their idea, not, I think, the Egyptian idea, that Jerusalem should be included in the autonomy. For Israel at the time, this was like, you know, for a religious Jew to eat pork, if you want. Begin was a member of the government, which was a labor government, which in 1967 proclaimed the application of the Israeli law and administration on all Jerusalem. And this was in response to the fact that between 48 or 49 and 67, Jordan, who held eastern Jerusalem after the war of 48, would not let Israel visit the holy Jewish sites, the Wailing Wall, the cemetery of Mount Scopus, and so on, of Mount of Olives, and so on. So we applied the law. United Jerusalem, as the Bible says, the city that was united. Here the U.S. wants us to change. Begin told us, we are packing. That is, we are going home without an agreement. This is 1 or 2 days before the agreement. The U.S. understood and they backed away. What was agreed was that the agreement will be appended, attached to it will be 3 letters. A letter by the U.S. stating that their policy on Jerusalem is what they said by 2 ambassadors in the U.N. I will not go into the details. It's not exactly the same, the 2 speeches, but that's not for now. The Egyptian letter said it's an occupied territory and so on. The Israeli letter said, and Begin asked me, I remember, to write down the law of 67, give it to him. It said that this is our position, the law of 67, of application of Israeli law to Jerusalem. And that took care of it. So here now we are on September 17th, and there is a text. The text was, in a way, at least on the Palestinian issue, in the Kissingerian terminology of constructive ambiguity or constructive obfuscation. That is, it was open for many interpretations, but it was there. There was a text. And we don't have the time to go into the text. On the Egyptian side, the notion was we will withdraw within 3 years from, basically it was 4 years almost, from Sinai, but security arrangements will be such to be detailed later in the Treaty of Peace, which will basically, in real terms, demilitarize most of Sinai. So the security element would be, or the concern would be pacified or neutralized. So here we are on September 17, in the evening, we fly from Camp David to Washington, to the White House. Before that, after a few days where there was no meeting between Sadat and Begin, only the teams that worked, Sadat came to Mr. Begin's, or first Begin came to Sadat's cabin and then Sadat to Mr. Begin's cabin. I was there too. It was a beautiful feeling. There are pictures to commemorate it. Well, I'm just on the phone in the picture, but the great good people are sitting there and they spoke, the 2 leaders, on their grandchildren, and they showed pictures of the grandchildren. It was a very good feeling. I attended the same feeling 3 years later in 81 in Alexandria, which was the last meeting between Sadat and Begin. And this is August of 81. And I remember being there. I remember Sadat, Begin introduced me again to Sadat. And they sat on the balcony as if they were a groom and a bride, ignoring all the ministers and everybody, and it was a very good feeling. But that's 3 years later. So now we are going to sign. Another problem occurred, not that night, but a couple of days later, which was the settlement. Begin promised Sadat not to establish settlements in the West Bank or Judea and Samaria during the Treaty of Peace negotiations, which were supposed to be 3 months or so, and basically were 5 months later. Carter understood it as if it was an open check for the whole period of negotiating on the Palestinian issue. And he thought that Begin did not fulfill his word. That came later. Sadat said, what's wrong with 3 months? Aaron Barak, a very respected jurist, later our Chief Justice, who was there in the meeting, I wasn't in the meeting, has notes whom he presented later that say that this was the promise by Begin for the 3 months or so, 5 months. But it became later a sticking point with Carter. But we are still on the evening of the signing. And lo and behold, the second Egyptian foreign minister resigns. This Muhammad Ibrahim Kamel, he said he was not agreeing to the agreement. And some of his helpers or assistants also, I remember kind of symbolically, Camp David has a map. So I, for memorabilia, I had all the participants, including Sadat, Begin, Carter, sign my map that night. But two Egyptian negotiators said to me, we will only sign after the full treaty of peace, and they did not sign. All the rest signed, including Sadat, as I said. And we signed the agreement that night, and again it was, and Begin knew he will have an opposition in Israel, in his own party. But he knew also that he will have the backing of the opposition in Israel, so he will not have a problem in passing the agreement through the Knesset, which he did after a few days. So here we have the Camp David Accords. And, you know, the Almighty has a very interesting ways in which he functions. We don't know them. But bringing to this one place the three so different people, Begin, Sadat, and Carter, and negotiating an agreement on a conflict which was raging for not only 30 years before, from 48, but even before, was really a major achievement. Now, both parties faced difficulties. I mentioned that the Egyptian foreign minister resigned. Sadat had a very tough response by the Arab countries. Many suspended relations with Egypt. In fact, the first Egyptian ambassador, whom I was privileged to welcome a year and a half later in Israel in 1980, and by the way, Begin was a very person of symbolics, so diplomatic relations, and the resident ambassador was very important to him. And it was agreed that after a certain withdrawal, not the full withdrawal from Sinai, the ambassador will come and then our ambassador will go to Israel, and it did happen. So the first Egyptian ambassador to Israel was their ambassador to, I believe, Morocco or some country in the north, in North Africa, who had to leave that country because of their opposition to the agreement. Israel, Begin had very tough internal criticism from his own party. I remember when we were in a meeting at his home, I should say this person was very democratic. I said before that we were convening every day 3 times in his cabin with the text and with the impressions and what's going on. Even me, I was the youngest and the most junior member, he let me speak. I think it was chutzpah on my part, because who are you? I mean, I'm the assistant to Dayan. Dayan is here, let him speak. But Begin was democratic, and he even gave me credit some time later, so it was very nice. In any case, Begin, of course, had his day in the Knesset, and the agreement came into effect. Now began the negotiations on the Treaty of Peace, which was to detail the Camp David Accords into the real thing practically. And they were rather difficult negotiations. They took place in the Blair House. Ambassador Kozlovsky, who is here, knows the Blair House. The Blair House is the official visitors' residence for the presidents of the United States. It's opposite the White House, and we had the negotiations there. And when you come, you know, there's a saying, the devil is in the details. So when you come to the details of how will Sinai be divided for security reasons, A, B, C, D, all this kind of thing. So that was a problem. Denormalization between Israel and Egypt, the embassies, the agreements on economy, on transportation, on tourism, all of that wasn't just, you know, when Sadat made his first speech in Israel, he said, we have to bring down this psychological barrier. And this was indeed the problem after 30 years of war. So we had a very difficult negotiations in the Blair House for about 6-7 weeks. And we finished and did not finish, which means problems came up. Give you two of them. What is the connection between the Egyptian bilateral side and the autonomy for the Palestinians? If one thing doesn't go, does the other thing freeze, or are they disconnected? The Egyptians are bound by the Arab League Security Pact. If, God forbid, there is a war between Israel and another Arab country, is Egypt bound or the peace is prevailing? We had to find solution for these problems and many others. So after 6 or 7 weeks in Washington, each delegation came back home, and there were a few remaining points which had to be finalized. So it took from November of end of, from mid-November or something like that, end of November 78 to March of 79 to air and iron these problems. By the way, during those 6 weeks in Washington, Begin was in Israel. We were, Dayan was the head, and Mr. Weizmann, our foreign, our defense minister, was there. I was the rapporteur of the delegation. I was sitting every night till 2-3 a.m. writing reports. Begin loved the texts, so we had to report to him daily. It was my role to sit every night and write those long cables as they were at the time, and they had to be prepared and sent, and the next, he would get them, let's say we finished 2-3 a.m., he would get them by 5 a.m. Washington time, which means, let's say, midday Israel time, and then he would read it carefully and write his own reactions and instructions, which we would get in 5 in the afternoon in Washington usually, or 7 in the afternoon, no, later, 10 in the evening, the reactions came. So it was kind of a very intensive dialogue between the delegation and the prime minister. Then Carter decided that we have to finish, so he decided to go to Egypt and Israel and try to finish. And again it was difficult, because each side had its own internal opposition. But in a visit in mid-March, the two parties found formulas to bridge upon the problems. And some of the formulas, I should be frank with you, were very diplomatic, very ambiguous, constructive ambiguity on these two issues, for instance, of the Arab League Pact or on the autonomy connection, the linkage between the autonomy. But we finished, and on 26 March 1979, in the White House, the agreement was, the Treaty of Peace was, excuse me, was signed. I'm not allergic to the agreement, it just, and it was signed, I remember, by the way, two anecdotes from that evening. I was, Carter, excuse me again, Carter had a big tent built next to the White House for a dinner for 3,000 people or something like that. And I was on the table with Americans and one Egyptian who was a parliament member who lost his leg in the Yom Kippur War. And he didn't know English, so I was his translator into from Arabic to English for the group and the dinner. And there was also the editor of a major Israeli newspaper who at the time there was still the old system of printing newspapers, not like today. And he wanted to make Sadat, Begin, and Carter sign the syncography for the, his new for the newspaper, and he was training the whole evening to say, "Mr. President, I'm the editor of so and so, and I want," and I was his sounding board. Did I do well? Finally, he did have the courage. He went and had them all sign. So it was an interesting evening. Now I'm summing up, and I'll open up for a few minutes of questions if there are. About 5 years later, and we had then the negotiation on normalization, we could tell stories about that, and on the autonomy with the Palestinians, they did not attend yet. Maybe I'll tell one normalization story. We were doing the agreement on civil aviation. And the Egyptians said to us they cannot bring to Israel the national carrier, Egypt Air, which is the counterpart of El Al. They will establish a special company, corporation for Israel. And the first day to the negotiation, they came with the name Lotus. Lotus is the flower, you know, the mythological flower. But in Hebrew, Lotus means will not fly. So the Israeli group was a little bit concerned about the name as it will be interpreted in Hebrew. So the Egyptians understood and they came with the name Nefertiti, which is the queen in the Egyptian history. And then some years later it was Sinai Air. Now to sum up, about 5 years after the Camp David Accords, I was in the airport with one of the ministers of the Begin government, of the government of Israel, who was then a Knesset member who opposed the agreement. And he said to me, "You know, I oppose the agreement, but if it sustains for 15 years, it was worthwhile." That was the minister that was opposing the agreement. He said it in 83, and he said, 10 more years, be okay. Now we are 40 years after Camp David, September. There were five wars between 48 and 60 and 73. There was no war between Egypt and Israel since 77, 78, 79. There were some unfortunate occurrences on the boundary, some people were killed, but no war. And they keep, and the parties are keeping the agreement strategically. It's true that what is known as normalization of the bilateral agreements, economy, culture, we have, I was involved in all of them, we have about 50 or many numbers of agreements, they were not implemented in a quality way. But the strategic part, that is the no more war part, and nowadays with all the occurrences in the Middle East in the last few years, as far as I know, and I'm not in government anymore, the strategic part is there, and it is important for both sides. And we even agreed, the agreement says that Sinai will be divided with three parts. Close to the canal, they can have a division, then in area B, some smaller forces, then in area C, almost no forces, and there will be something on our side, area D. I know that we let them add some forces because of they have the Daesh, the SIS people in Sinai, which they fight, and we try to help. Also, the United Nations refused to support the agreement, so we had to establish a multinational force and observers, which are there. I was involved in negotiating that very extensively. And so the agreement is kept in its strategic side, and both countries adhere to it. So I leave it to your judgment whether Camp David was worthwhile. In my view, it was very worthwhile. Thank you very much.